From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The fact of the matter is, Rosa Parks was not only the mother of the modern civil rights movement, she was the mother of this nation.
Al Sharpton, Bill Clinton, Aretha Franklin, Bernice King join Congress members, senators, pastors, civil rights leaders, and many thousands of others for the funeral of Rosa Parks in Detroit. We'll play excerpts of the more than 7-hour service, including the eulogy by Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Her legacy is secure, her work unfinished.
I came into Detroit last night. 75,000 Negroes walking in the cold to see her body. If they don't vote on Tuesday, they wasted her time.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Detroit Wednesday, over 4,000 mourners attended the funeral service of civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks. The service lasted over 7 hours, 3 hours past its scheduled time. Guests included the Reverend Jesse Jackson, former President Bill Clinton, singer Aretha Franklin. Rosa Parks died October 24th at the age of 92. We'll play excerpts of the service in just a few minutes. The Bush administration is refusing to confirm or deny a Washington Post account that the CIA is using a secret Soviet-era prison run in Eastern Europe to hold prisoners. The prison's apparently a part of the global network of CIA-run prisons in several countries. At the request of U.S. officials, the Post did not reveal the location of the facilities. Human Rights Watch has identified Poland and Romania as likely locations, citing flight records of CIA aircraft transporting detainees from Afghanistan. A spokesperson for the Polish Defense Ministry denied the allegations to the Financial Times. A Romanian spokesperson declined comment. Agence France-Presse is reporting the Czech Republic Interior Minister recently turned down a U.S. request to set up a detention center on its territory. In light of the Washington Post revelations, Bush administration officials insist they will not tolerate the use of torture at home or in any foreign prisons. This is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
We're doing everything we can to protect America, but we obviously do everything we can to do it in a way that's consistent with our legal obligations.
Yet there are indications the Bush administration, there's no indications the Bush administration has dropped a controversial proposal that would exempt CIA agents from a Senate ban on torture. Speaking in New York on Wednesday, President Jimmy Carter criticized the Bush administration's stance.
The insistence by our government that the CIA or others have the right to torture prisoners in Guantanamo and around the world is just one indication of what this administration has done. That's a radical departure from past policy.
Former President Carter speaking on the Today Show. He also lashed out at the Bush administration's justifications for the war in Iraq. Carter said, quote, "I think that the claims that Saddam was involved in 9/11 and the claims he had massive weapons of mass destruction that would threaten our country were manipulated at least to mislead the American people into going to war." The White House responded Wednesday to a Democratic decision that moved the Senate to a secret session on pre-war intelligence. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said, quote, "If Democrats want to talk about the threat that Saddam Hussein posed and the intelligence, they might want to start with looking at the previous administration and their own statements that they've made." McClellan said the Democrats, quote, "used the intelligence to come to the same conclusion that Saddam Hussein and his regime were a threat." The Washington Post is reporting several top colleagues of Karl Rove believe he should be dismissed from his position as chief of staff to President Bush. The Post reports senior Republicans say Rove will have to, at minimum, issue an apology for making misleading statements about his role in the outing of the CIA operative Valerie Plame. A Republican strategist who's discussed Rove's future with top administration officials said, quote, "Carl does not have any real enemies in the White House, but there are a lot of people in the White House wondering how they can put this behind them if the cloud remains over Carl. You cannot have that fresh start as long as Carl is there," unquote. Meanwhile, indicted White House aide Louis Libby is set to make his first court appearance at an arraignment hearing in Washington today. Libby faces 5 charges, including obstruction of justice and perjury in the outing of Plame's identity. This news on Bolivia: the country's former president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, was served more than wine and cheese at a Washington, D.C. luncheon on Tuesday. U.S. citizens acting on behalf of Bolivian human rights organizations handed Sanchez de Lozada a summons to appear before a Bolivian investigation into human rights abuses under his administration. The allegations center around the deaths of more than 50 people during an anti-government protest in the fall of 2003. Sanchez de Lozada fled the country shortly after and now lives in Washington. Doug Hertzler is the American anthropologist who delivered the legal papers.
I approached him and I said, Mr. Sanchez de Lozada, I hereby serve you with legal documents from the Bolivian government requiring you to appear in court to answer questions about the wrongful deaths of 2003. And he took the documents from me, and but the man standing next to him immediately began to say, don't do that, and push me from the room. And at that point, I didn't really see what happened after that. I'm pretty sure Mr. Sanchez de Lozada didn't say anything. He just had a kind of stunned look on his face.
U.S. anthropologist Doug Hertzler. In Iraq, separate attacks claimed the lives of at least 53 Iraqi civilians and six U.S. troops Wednesday. Two U.S. troops were killed near Ramadi when insurgents reportedly shot down their helicopter. The Washington Post reports U.S. aircraft returned and dropped bombs near the crash site, killing at least 20 people. Elsewhere in the country, a suicide bomber exploded a minibus in an outdoor market in the town of Musaib, killing 20 people, wounding 60 others. In other Iraq news, the interim Iraqi government announced plans to reincorporate thousands of dismissed military officers from the Saddam Hussein regime. The officers were laid off April 2003 by Paul Bremer, the former head of the U.S. occupation. Analysts interpreted the move as an attempt to lure back disaffected Sunni Arab former soldiers who joined the resistance after the dismissals. In this country, a coalition of grassroots organizations is calling on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to release a new inspector general's investigation into the wrongdoing by former chair Kenneth Tomlinson. Common Cause, the Center for Digital Democracy, and Free Press have urged the CPB's board of directors to immediately release the report, which has only been reviewed in private. Tomlinson's accused of committing ethical and procedural breaches and misusing CPB funds. In other media news, CNN has replaced primetime news anchor Aaron Brown with Anderson Cooper, who currently occupies the network's 7 to 8 p.m. time slot. Aaron Brown will leave CNN. In France, riots that have gripped several Paris suburbs continued for a seventh day Wednesday. The protests erupted following the deaths of two teenagers last week. Young people clashed with police and burnt cars in the Saint-Saint-Denis region north of the French capital. Protesters told the Associated Press the unrest was an expression of frustration with unemployment and police harassment in the areas. The suburbs are home to a large North African immigrant population. One protester said, quote, people are joining together to say, we've had enough. We live in ghettos. Everyone lives in fear. Police say they've made at least 35 arrests. The Washington Post is reporting House Republicans are pushing a measure that would remove nearly 300,000 people off food stamps. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the number includes 70,000 legal immigrants, 40,000 children who would lose eligibility for subsidized school lunches. The food stamp cuts are one of several measures included in a congressional budget cutting package. Others include a $5 billion reduction in state child support enforcement and a cut of almost $400 million in foster care programs. The Post notes these cuts would be more than offset by the $70 billion in tax cuts Republicans will be pushing in the coming weeks. And thousands of people took part in the World Can't Wait protests against President Bush Wednesday. Rallies and student walkouts took place in major cities across the country on the anniversary of Bush's reelection a year ago. In New York, students walked out of schools to join a march that drew thousands of people to Times Square. This World Can't Wait national coordinator, Deborah Sweet.
We have to build a movement expressing the interests and intentions of millions and millions of people in this country to create a political situation where Bush has to leave office.
In San Francisco, over 2,000 people demonstrated. 10 people were arrested, including 9 for blocking traffic. Police used force to disrupt a die-in at a downtown intersection. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Juan Gonzalez will be joining us shortly. Over 4,000 people gathered in Detroit for the funeral of civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks on Wednesday. The funeral capped a week of tributes to the woman often referred to as the mother of the civil rights movement. Parks died last week at the age of 92. She'd lived in Detroit since the late 50s. It marked the third major tribute to Parks this week. On Sunday, a memorial service was held in her former home of Montgomery, Alabama. It was there where in 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested December 1st after she refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white passenger. This act of civil disobedience sparked the Montgomery bus boycott and the civil rights movement. Her act of resistance was felt around the world. Parks was also honored this week in Washington, D.C., where she became the first woman ever to lie in honor in the U.S. Capitol. But the biggest tribute was held on Wednesday, when thousands filled the Greater Grace Temple of Detroit. Reverend Jackson's eulogy ended with him and the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, on stage together paying tribute to Rosa Parks. Other speakers included the Reverend Al Sharpton, Nation of Islam leader, Minister Louis Farrakhan, President Bill Clinton, the Reverend Bernice King, the daughter of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. We begin our coverage with Reverend Jackson. In his remarks, he urged the people of Detroit to honor the legacy of Rosa Parks by voting in Detroit's mayoral election on Tuesday.
Is this a sentimental ceremony or is this a freedom rally?
Her legacy is secure. Her work unfinished.
I came into Detroit last night. 75,000 Negroes walking in the cold to see her body. If they don't vote on Tuesday, they wasted her time. You mean in the chart? You elected Engler as governor by not voting? You mean in the chart? Motown, hip-hip Detroit? You mean you voted 20% of your 20% voted a month ago? You mean you're going to have a national performance watching a dead sister and then don't vote? I don't believe in voting. You believe in Medicare? You believe in Medicaid? You believe in public education? You believe in Pell Grants? So you must believe in voting.
In his speech, Reverend Jackson called for a statue of Rosa Parks to be erected in the halls of Congress. He also criticized President Bush's recent choice for the Supreme Court, Sam Alito.
Congressman Jackson has a bill to be put in the Great Hall of Congress, a life-size statue of Rosa Parks. If John Calhoun can be there, and General Robert E. Lee, and Jefferson Davis, men who engaged in sedition, secession, slavery, segregation, and treason. Just maybe we need a guardian angel to watch over them in the halls of Congress. Perhaps George Bush, who wants to give her ceremony, can sign the Voting Rights Act and extend it with enforcement powers. President Bush, on yesterday, gave homage to Rosa Parks and then put forth the nation a extreme right-wing judge, antithetical to everything Rosa Parks ever stood for. He put forth an anti-Rosa Parks judge. Not unlike last year, he put a wreath on Dr. King's graveyard
And the next day, a lawyer at the Supreme Court to kill affirmative action there, but he sticks out his hands as always something up his sleeves. Perhaps a White House conference on civil rights. Why not 50 years later? Washing bodies float down the rivers of New Orleans. No plan for rescue. No plan for relocation. No plan for reconstruction. This fan. Did the main Americans no health insurance? The surplus culture for the few and the deficit culture for the masses? Yes, maybe. We need a White House conference on civil rights. Mr. Mayor, why not right now? On the river in Detroit. The Rosa Parks Park. Where we can entomb her body. And have for generations unborn this woman who sacrificed, made America better. Why not now some action, turn our mourning into some living memorial?
The Reverend Jesse Jackson delivering the eulogy at the funeral of Rosa Parks. President Bill Clinton was the first speaker of the day. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
Rosa Parks ignited the most significant social movement in modern American history. To finish the work that spawned the Civil War and redeem the promise of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. For 50 more years, she moved beyond the bus, continuing her work on that promise. It was my honor to present her with the Presidential Medal of Freedom and to join the leaders of Congress in presenting her with a Congressional Gold Medal. I remember well when she sat with Hillary in the box of the first family at the State of the Union address in 1999 and how the entire Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, rose as one to recognize that she had made us all better people in a better country. When I first met Rosa Parks, I was reminded of what Abraham Lincoln said when he was introduced to Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. He said, "So this is the little lady who started the Great War." This time, Rosa's war was fought by Martin Luther King's rules. Civil disobedience. Yeah, yeah. Peaceful resistance. But a war nonetheless for one America in which the law of the land means the same thing for everybody. Rosa Parks, as we saw again today, was small in stature with delicate features. But the passing years did nothing to dim the light that danced in her eyes, the kindness and strength you saw in her smile, or the dignity of her voice. To the end, she radiated that kind of grace and serenity that God specially gives to those who stand in the line of fire for freedom and touch even the hardest hearts. I remember as if it were yesterday, that fateful day 50 years ago. I was a 9-year-old Southern white boy who rode a segregated bus every single day of my life. I sat in the front, black folk sat in the back. When Rosa showed us that black folks didn't have to sit in the back anymore, two of my friends and I, who strongly approved of what she had done, decided we didn't have to sit in the front anymore. It was just a tiny gesture by three ordinary kids. But that tiny gesture was repeated over and over again, millions and millions of times, in the hearts and minds of children, their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, proving that she did help to set us all free. That great civil rights song that Nina Simone did so well, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could fly like a bird in the sky. The end says, I wish that you knew how it feels to be me. Then you'd see and agree that everyone should be free. Now that our friend Rosa Parks has gone on to her just reward, now that she has gone home and left us behind, let us never forget that in that simple act and a lifetime of grace and dignity, she showed us every single day what it means to be free. She made us see and agree that everyone should be free. God bless you, Rosa. God bless you.
Former President Bill Clinton at the funeral of Rosa Parks, and we'll go back to that in a minute. Nina Simone singing, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 380 radio and TV stations around the country, Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. And for radio listeners, you can go to our website and see and watch the funeral of Rosa Parks. Yes, Reverend Bernice King, the daughter of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, also delivered remarks on behalf of her mother. Coretta Scott King recently suffered a stroke. This is Bernice King.
She sparked a prairie fire that continues to blaze brightly in the hearts of freedom-loving people in all nations. And the nonviolent revolution she set in motion continues to reverberate in nation after nation as an inspiration to human liberation movements everywhere. Rosa Parks provided us with a beautiful example of the power of one. how one courageous person can make a great difference in advancing human freedom. She showed us the power of humility and disciplined nonviolence in winning hearts and minds to support our freedom struggle. And she set for the entire world a vibrant example of African-American womanhood fully engaged in the work of building a more just and decent society.
The Reverend Bernice King, daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. Among other speakers at Rosa Parks' funeral was Jennifer Granholm, the first female governor of Michigan, elected in 2002. This is a part of what she had to say.
Stands for every one of us improbable warriors in every seemingly small moment where truth and justice are at risk. She offered every one of us this example of a splendid paradox, the paradox of quiet strength. No more quiet than strong, certainly no more strong than quiet, each reinforcing the other. She was powerful because she was improbable. She was unexpected. She was untitled. And what has been written of Gandhi is certainly true of Rosa Parks, that her greatness lay in doing what everybody could do but doesn't. We will all say today that the greatest tribute that we could pay to our improbable warrior is to continue battling and to do so in a way that honors her life. And I, like you, imagine a day when the war will be won, when a brilliant 8-year-old chess player has the same chances in life, whether she lives in Livonia or off of Livernois, whether the we know that this war will be won when the son of a barber on Grand River receives from each of us the same looks of hope and words of encouragement as the son of a doctor in Grand Rapids. We know that the war will be won when the city of Bloomfield Hills and the city of Detroit have the same college graduation rates. And the same low prison incarceration rates as well. We know that we will be winning Mrs. Parks' war, our war, when it's yesterday's news that a newly elected governor or senator or president is a woman or a person of color. Yesterday's news. We know we will be winning the war when people in the state of Michigan do not have to vote on whether diversity in our university classrooms is a good thing. We know we will see signs that we are winning this war when love overwhelms fear and acts of quiet strength become our daily bread. So, good night, Mrs. Parks, from the state of Michigan, to our own gently powerful war hero, because by your actions, you have given us your final marching orders. We are enlisted in this war, and on behalf of the state of Michigan, ma'am, we are reporting for duty.
Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. Rosa Parks spent much of her life in Detroit, Michigan. Among the other speakers, Reverend Joseph Lowery, longtime civil rights activist, co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was also active in the movement to desegregate public transportation in Alabama in the early 50s. This is Reverend Lowery.
Can't do justice to Rosa Parks letting your tribute end in ceremony. You have to move from ceremony to sacrament. Sacrament takes up where ceremony leaves off. See, ceremony is like putting a ring on her finger at the wedding. But sacrament is ringing her life with love and joy every day and every hour. The sacrament, you know, baptism is a ceremony, but living holy after the baptism is sacramental. And I believe if we could do justice to Sister Parks, we must not stop with sacrament. The president of these United States engaged in ceremony in the rotunda, but he stopped short of sacrament when he missed an opportunity to name somebody to the court through the spirit of Rosa Parks for diversity and minority rights. He stopped short of sacrament. I call upon you today, let's don't stop with this ceremony. You must move from ceremony to sacrament. Sacramental honor means that never again can you let an election pass without getting up and casting your vote. Sacrament means that we must not tolerate homelessness and hunger in the midst of our community. Sacrament means that we know where the weapons of mass destruction are. They're not in Iraq. They're in Detroit and Chicago and Atlanta and Montgomery. That's where the weapons of mass destruction are. Million people in this country with no health insurance. That's a weapon of mass destruction. Minimum wage is a weapon of mass destruction. And in the spirit of Rosa Parks, as I take my seat, we must sacramentally understand that drug addiction and drug selling is a weapon of mass self-destruction. And in the spirit of Rosa Parks, we must rise up and sacramentally share that addiction. Finally, we must understand in the spirit of Rosa Parks, in the spirit of saintly womanhood, we must teach our young people, as children, to stop having children. That's a weapon of mass self-destruction. And so I go to take my seat now, calling you to go from ceremony to sacrament. Sitting in Montgomery the other day as I spoke was Dr. Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, old homegirl from Alabama. And I took advantage of the moment because she couldn't move. She had to sit there and hear what I had to say. Mr. Mayor. Well, I come all the way from Atlanta. You ought to give me an extra minute. I said to Condoleezza, she made a beautiful tribute to Ms. Park. But I said, Dr. Rice, Sister Secretary of State, what a glorious tribute it would be if you and the governor of Alabama and the mayor of Montgomery would join John Conyers and Sister Kilpatrick and John Lewis in extending the Voting Rights Act, that would be a...
The Reverend Joseph Lowery, co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Like many of the speakers at Rosa Parks' funeral, the Reverend Al Sharpton connected the civil rights struggles to the struggles taking place today.
The fact of the matter is, Rosa Parks was not only the mother of the modern civil rights movement, she was the mother of this nation. Why would you say that, Sharpton? Because you called George Washington the father of the nation, but when he became father, we wasn't included in the nation. Women were not included in the nation. The first time we had a parent in this nation is when all of us was included, and Rosa Parks did that on December 1st, 1955. I heard somebody say Jim Crow is who she fought, and Jim Crow is still around. But Jim Crow is old. That's not who I'm mindful of today. The problem is Jim Crow has sons. The one we gotta battle is James Crow Jr. Esquire. He's a little more educated. He's a little slicker. He's a little more polished, but the results are the same. He doesn't put you in the back of the bus. He just puts referendums on the ballot to end affirmative action where you can't go to school. He doesn't call you a racial name. He just marginalizes your existence. He doesn't tell you that he's set against you. He sets up institutional racism, where you have a nation respond looking for weapons in Iraq that are not there, but can't see a hurricane in Louisiana that is there.
The Reverend Al Sharpton, as we end our coverage of the funeral of Rosa Parks with the final words of Reverend Jesse Jackson's eulogy. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, joined with Reverend Jackson for a moving ending of the service.
Young brothers, stop by and tell Emmett Till your dying inspired me and I made America better. Stop by and said, Dr. King, we're still marching up the King's highway. It's dark, but the morning comes. The Lord is our light and our salvation. Whom shall we fear? They're still threatening us. They're still killing us and locking us up. But yea, though I walk through the valleys and shadows of death, I fear no evil,
no, no.
For thou,
oh, yeah,
art with me,
yeah,
and thy rod,
oh, Lord,
and thy staff,
so
they comfort me.
Oh, yeah.
Can I get a witness?
Well, well.
Tell my hail ya. We're gonna move on up.
Oh, no.
We're gonna move on up.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a little higher.
Little higher.
Tell to them some glad morning.
Some glad.
Some glad morning. Some glad morning. When this life is over, I'll fly away. I'll fly away. I'll screw the silver sockets of glory. One glad morning. You can sit down there where you want to sit down. Sit down anywhere in heaven. There'll be no handcuffs up there. There'll be no mean police up there. They get kind of sitting down. Just walk. Just walk.
Oh, yeah.
Around heaven. All day.
To
it won't be long now. Rise.
To
rise.
To land.
Higher. 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 It's morning time. It's morning time. Away.
We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!
will never grow old.
And then there was Rosa. She flew away.
Come on, somebody put your hands together for the Lord.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up with the last segment of today's show, coming out of the funeral of Rosa Parks in Detroit. More than 4,000 people crowded into the church to say their final farewell. Well, here in New York City, the mayoral election is taking place next Tuesday. The mayor's job in this city is often referred to as the toughest job in America and one of the most influential government posts in the country. The Republican incumbent billionaire Mike Bloomberg is seeking a second term in office, while former Democratic Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer is trying to unseat him. The race is set to go down in history as the most expensive political campaign outside a presidential race, with Michael Bloomberg outspending Fernando Ferrer by tens of millions of dollars. Polls have consistently shown that Ferrer is behind in the race. Last Tuesday night, he and Michael Bloomberg debated for the second and last time before the election. Juan, you have been covering city politics for many years as a columnist for the New York Daily News. You've written extensively about this administration as well as previous ones, and also written a number of books. Harvest of Empire is about the history of Latinos in America. Your latest book, Fallout, is about what happened after 9/11, the environmental fallout at Ground Zero. And have written stories from a forgotten America. Roll down your window. Your columns about the voices we don't hear. And I think that's a good launching point here to talk about this race in the context of national politics in cities around the country.
Yeah, well, actually, Amy, I just completed a sort of a more in-depth analysis of this 2005 mayoral race, which I've called Where Have All the Fighters Gone? Because I think that one of the things, as I have spent close to 30 years now covering urban politics in the United States, and not just here in New York, but in Philadelphia and other cities, and I have been actually astounded at the lack of in-depth analysis of this race in New York, which is probably, other than the New Jersey senatorial race, the biggest, the most high-profile election in the United States this year. And one of the amazing things to me is how even within the progressive movement, which prides itself on in-depth analysis or looking at the deeper ramifications of political processes, that there's been so little of it in this race, and especially in terms of the what is happening in urban America today. I understand part of the problem has been that many progressive journalists and the progressive movement in general has been so fixated on these huge national problems and international problems like the war in Iraq and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and global warming and a variety of issues. But there has been really a dearth of analysis. What is going on in the cities of America? What are the class forces that are shaping the modern American city? And what does what do political battles have to do with that? And it's almost like it's become a blind spot of the progressive movement in the United States. And one of the points I try to make in my piece is that there are class and racial reasons for that, that the progressive movement in America is still largely confined to middle class and sometimes upper class folks who don't have a lot of day-to-day direct connection with what is happening in urban America. The great problem that capitalism has confronted in the last decades is that the great centers of finance and commerce have all become overwhelmingly populated by African Americans and immigrants from the colonial and neocolonial nations of the Third World. So that what's happened is that even the progressive movement is no longer directly tied to the populations of the great cities of the United States. And I think that, therefore, they're not recognizing the enormous changes that are occurring, because what has happened, especially now, is the United States is reaching peak oil production, but it started happening in the oil crisis of the 1970s, is that the ruling circles of the United States are trying to restructure the cities to regain control of the cities, because they can no longer control the political superstructure, because the voting power of these communities has grown of these immigrant communities has grown to such a degree. So they are attempting to recapture control and actually depopulate the major cities. One of the things that I encountered throughout my coverage of the 4 years of the Bloomberg administration in every working class community that I visit is the local leaders are telling me they're taking our land. They're creating all of these huge development projects. They're making it impossible to live, whether it's Williamsburg or Greenpoint in Brooklyn or even the South Bronx. Harlem has been completely gentrified. And what has happened is that the ruling circles have been in the process of dismantling democratic government by taking away the tax base of these cities, so that even if candidates from the working class or minority communities get elected, they will have no ability to manage their cities independently, because the tax base is being eroded, and all of these stadium projects and these others, what they are, they're siphoning off the tax base to take economic power away from the growing majorities of the cities and leave them with political power but no ability to administer government. And the Bloomberg administration has been unparalleled in its ability to do this. So unfortunately, most of the progressives and the liberals in this city, amazingly, in both the Democratic and the Republican Party and among independents, have basically accepted the position of the mass media and the ruling circles of the city, that that the Ferrer campaign has no issues to speak of, is not representative of the aspirations of the people, when in fact, when you look at the platforms and positions of the two campaigns, they're night and day in terms of like the issues that they raise. Just one example why Wall Street is so much against Ferrer. He proposed a reimposition of a sales tax on stock transfers, on stock sales in New York City to help fund public education. Everything in New York City is taxed except the sale of stock. sales tax on stocks would produce hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues. As soon as Ferrer proposed that several months ago, he was attacked across the board by all of the media. He proposed the reimposition of a commuter tax because New York City commuters from the middle class who come into this city do not pay income tax, even though they spend 8 to 10 hours a day in this city using the services that New York City residents pay for. They pay no taxes for those services. So that created a furor. Both in his taxing policies and his opposition to working class, to the driving out of the working class in the rental housing, and through a variety of positions, not to mention the fact that he opposes the Iraq war. He has called for a withdrawal of the troops from Iraq, and he has publicly stated he opposes military recruitment in schools, in public schools. All positions that you would think that the progressive movement, which is so concerned about what is happening in Iraq, would find to their liking. So what's happened is, as Wayne Barrett said, he's been saying recently, the veteran reporters got more experience with urban politics than I do. Wayne Barrett said recently that in all of his years, he has never seen the level of distortion of a political campaign that has occurred in the last year around this race. He's astounded by how all of the newspapers, all of the corporate press, are all saying the same thing. But yet the progressives are not asking themselves why, if the rich of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, if all of the corporate media are unified in their opposition to this candidacy, what's wrong with that picture? It's amazing to me that there's been no analysis. So that's why I tried to put it together. It's basically a compilation of my columns and some of the main things that I've learned from this over the last few years.
Juan, in terms of the money in this race, the most expensive race in the history of this country outside a presidential race, Mike Bloomberg was a billionaire before he was mayor. He's given a tremendous amount. What is the figure in terms of just charitable contributions to organizations in the city outside of the actual campaign spending?
Right. Well, he is on track to spend $100 million
on
the race itself. But what has not gotten a lot of attention is that Bloomberg was a philanthropist before. He was giving about $25 to $30 million a year in contributions to charitable causes. Then the year before he began running for mayor, he suddenly sharply increased those charitable contributions to over $100 million a year and has continued to escalate them. Last year, he gave out $140 million in contributions, basically to nonprofits in New York City, some nationally, like to his alma mater, Johns Hopkins, but most of them to groups in New York City. That means that over the last 5 years, Michael Bloomberg has given out close to $600 million in charitable donations to groups, most of them in New York City. In addition to the $100 million he has spending on this race, in addition to the $73 million he spent to defeat Mark Green in 2001, so he's on track basically to have spent close to $1 billion to maintain his control of the New York City government. An astounding number.
It's surprising he has to spend that much in the campaign, given how much he has spent personally more than $500 million on organizations in the city.
Right. Not to mention the power of incumbency normally an incumbent is already way up, has a leg way up on the challenger.
And how much has Ferrer spent?
Ferrer has spent about $6 million, right? And this is $6 million not just against Bloomberg. He spent the bulk of that in a primary against four other Democratic opponents. So he's maybe spent a couple of million dollars. That's not a small amount of money to have raised. Rudy Giuliani, in his last race, spent $14 million, which was considered an enormous amount of money at that time. So it has taken local politics, the financing of local politics, to an exponentially higher level when it comes to actual financing.
Juan, in looking at this race, how it fits into other old mayor races, for example, Los Angeles, where Mayor Villaraigosa is now in control. Freddie Ferrer, the Democratic candidate, how much support has he gotten from the Democratic Party? Much was made of a South Bronx event where the former president of the United States, Bill Clinton, came out. Was it in support of Fernando Ferrer?
Yes, yes. So Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have both come out in support of Fernando Ferrer. However, their staffs and their actions have sent a clear signal that they are nominally supporting him, but really not investing much effort and time in the campaign, as has happened with many of the well-to-do Democrats in this race. I mean, Steven Rattner, who is one of the biggest national Democratic Party fundraisers, his wife is the finance chair of the National Democratic Party under Howard Dean, held a Bloomberg fundraiser and told the New York Post that I don't know any Democrat who's backing Fernando Ferrer. And
she's the finance chair of the Democratic
Party.
Well,
this is the husband of the finance chair of the National Democratic Party. And he himself is a big financial backer. The upper strata of the Democratic Party have made it clear they don't want to have anything to do with this race, and they like Michael Bloomberg. And one of the things that people don't understand who have not been in New York City is that for the past 30 years, every candidate for mayor of New York from either party has come from the borough of Manhattan, where all of the wealth and power and the elite of the city live for the most part. And not since Mario Cuomo came out of Queens in 1977 to run on the Liberal Party line against Ed Koch, has anyone from any of the other boroughs even run for mayor? Because basically the Manhattan elite control politics in New York City. And even the Democratic liberals of the past, like Ruth Messenger, Mark Green, David Dinkins, they all came out of the Manhattan power structure. So part of what is operating in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a class bias against people from the outer boroughs, the more working class candidates, and especially from the poorest borough in the city, which is where Fernando Ferrer comes out of.
And that's the Bronx. We only have about 45 seconds in wrapping up this discussion. Where you see this going? There's only a few more days in this race.
Well, at this point, it's highly unlikely that Ferrer will win. Bloomberg seems to be assured of victory, although I think it remains to be seen. You never know in politics, but I think it's Bloomberg's assured of victory. But I think the more important thing is for the progressive movement to take a deep look at how its class and racial biases were involved in this race and how its lack of analysis of the stakes involved determined the way that that many progressives in this city functioned in relationship to this race. And hopefully lessons will be learned so that in the future there will be candidates that more clearly represent working people and the racial and ethnic minorities in this city and around the country.
Juan, we have to leave it there. We'll certainly continue to follow this story and the underlying story. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salome. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.